podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is July 8th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up later in today's program, we look at which L.A. restaurants receive stars in the new California Michelin Guide, and also which notable ones did not make the list. That's coming up in about half an hour. But we start with some grim news in the fight against homelessness. The homeless population in L.A. County jumped 12% this year compared with the year prior. And in the city of Los Angeles, the numbers were worse. Homelessness increased 16%. All that comes from the Greater LA Homeless Count that was conducted this past January. The stats were released earlier this morning. And among the findings, while almost 49,000 people were helped off the streets, nearly 55,000 others became homeless. So right there, the problem seems to be outpacing solutions. Here to break down the numbers, we have Peter Lin. He's executive director of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, also known as LASA. That's the organization in charge of overseeing homeless services for all of Greater LA. Peter, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you.
Now, the big question a lot of listeners will want to know, Peter, is why? Why is this happening?
Well, I think the core issue, and this is true for homelessness in our region but across the country, is housing affordability. We have the least affordable housing market in America by any number of different metrics. We have a very high number of Angelenos who are paying more than half their income for rent and just hanging on by their fingertips. There's a lot of folks who are right on edge and falling into homelessness. We were able to lift, as you said, a large number of people out of homelessness and more fell in. So this is something that we're seeing in Los Angeles County. We've seen this across the state as our colleagues and neighbors are reporting out their information. It is a statewide issue for California.
Okay,
we're able to extend the reach of the services we have, but more people are falling in.
Now, okay, so housing affordability, you say, is a problem. Then who in California is coming up with solutions to that problem? Because, I mean, no disrespect, Peter, but that seems to be above your head a little bit.
Well, it is outside our range, and I think that's one of the things that's very important for the homeless crisis system to elevate to policymakers and to the general public is there are issues at work here that we all need to address. Housing affordability is based on the expansion of housing stock and building. It's based on land use policies. But housing affordability is also based on rent policies. It's based on the availability of eviction defense for people in courts. It's based on the capacity of landlords to raise rents without check. Those are all measures that can take policy positions. A state can take policy positions. Localities, municipalities can take policy positions. And you're right, it's not in our zone. But the fact is that the renters in the county of Los Angeles are under tremendous pressure, and many of them are falling into homelessness. So it's an issue we need to elevate.
And one more thing on this. When you say the state can take a position, is that something that the top, Governor Gavin Newsom, has to address?
Well, I think there were a number of legislative proposals at the state that looked at anti-gouging measures for restriction on rent increases. There were measures that have afforded protection requiring just cause evictions. There are a number of different policies and legislative stances that the state could take. I think there's a wide range of things that the state needs to take a look at.
Talking to Peter Lin, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. How does this increase that we've seen in homelessness in LA compare to the rest of the state?
Well, you know, as the different continuums across the region and the state report out, I think, just taking a simple average of the ones that we've seen so far, they're all showing, or the bulk of them are showing increases, about 35% increases, you know, if you just took a simple average. That's a lot of increased homelessness across various communities. They're not all the same size, so that's not a weighted average. But as a pulse check against the housing affordability issues and the other challenges that the state are facing, I think, you know, we can definitely say this is a statewide problem. So Los Angeles County was less than that increase. I think we could look to the resources that voters put in place through Measure H as a very important factor in housing more people. So, but for the resources that we have locally, our numbers would have been in that range. But I can also say that this is something that that Los Angeles County has a unique affordability challenge in terms of having the least affordable market in America.
But generally, these numbers indicate that Angelenos should not feel alone on this issue, on this problem.
I think that's true. I think we do need state-level action. I think we also need to recognize that housing stock is important, and we do need to build. That's a long-term solution. In the meantime, we need some protection for renters in the near term.
When it comes to veterans, we've seen some good numbers there. What do you think is the reason when it comes to veterans maybe surviving this or maybe having a better fate, at least so far, when it comes to homelessness, especially lately?
You know, when you look at homelessness, I think one of the stories that comes out of the data each year is that resources really matter. Veterans, year after year, the federal government has allocated new funding for short-term rental assistance through the Supportive Services Veterans Families Program and deep supportive services with long-term rental support through the HUD-VASH program that provides permanent supportive housing for veterans. And both of those, Los Angeles has seen increases in funding, and those funds have really held the line in terms of increases that we would otherwise have projected for veterans experiencing homelessness. We did see a slight decrease, but I'll tell you, if you look at how many people we counted in 2018, there's about 3,900 homeless veterans. Over the course of the year, this system and these resources were able to house over 2,800 veterans, and the number only moved by about a dozen down. So in almost three-quarters of the veterans that we counted got housed, and yet new veterans became homeless and fell in and took their place. But this is the resource that, you know, this is the population for which there are the deepest resources, and they actually did show the impact of those resources.
Well, let's get into resources, because almost 3 years ago, Angelenos approved measures H and HHH, one a bond, the other a sales tax, both fund efforts to combat homelessness. Could the population count, Peter, have been worse without those two measures?
Well, there's no question that, you know, if you look at the people housed using just the new Measure H money, which was about 8,600 individuals over the course of last year, if you, you know, just presume that those folks would not have been able to get rehoused, and you add them to our count, LA County would have had increases that are similar to the rest of the state. I think those resources have been effective in housing people. We were actually able to lift over 21,600 people out of homelessness using those resources and the rest of what the continuum can deploy from the city, the county, and the federal government. And that actually helped reduce the overall increase. But those resources, coupled with a really challenging rental market, have created a position where we're lifting people out and more people are falling in.
Peter, where can you point in terms of tangible results from the H and Triple H money that's been spent so far here in Los Angeles?
Well, I think it's important to remember that Proposition Triple H is capital funding for new development. So those buildings take time. I think the first one opened last week, and it's a pretty impressive structure in the San Fernando Valley. Over the course of the upcoming fiscal year 2019-20, you know, there are 1,400 units that are scheduled to be deployed. I think that, you know, building takes time, and we have a challenging environment for construction. For Measure H, I think we can look right to the greatly expanded capacity of our homeless assistance system to connect with people. We were able to reach more than 75,000 people with services last year. We're able to use those resources to actually rehouse 21,600. And the rest of the folks, you know, got some relief and some assistance. And that has helped move people toward a housing outcome, which is obviously that's the goal for the system.
Why do you think, Peter, it's taken so long with the bridge housing, especially in all the different districts in the city of Los Angeles? It seems like the enthusiasm is there, but when it comes actually down to planning something, getting something built, it seems like that is a struggle for the city.
I think it's a real challenge with community opposition and community engagement, and this is a fact that we see in many communities and many regions. It is often the case that people can lead from a sense of fear, and opposed the siting of new facilities. We worked diligently. The council members, the council offices, the community partners, our allies at the United Way, everyone in campaign have worked to raise the consciousness. But there is some opposition. And I will also say that construction in Los Angeles does take more time. It is a very expensive. I think we have one of the most expensive regions for construction in the country. Part of which is due to the robust economy. Lots of building is taking place, and that has put some constraints there. But we really do need community members to turn out and support these programs and give opportunity for our homeless neighbors to get under shelter and get rehoused.
But what would you say, Peter, is the one thing it would take to actually spur action? Because I hear this all the time. We want to end this. We want to make sure that it doesn't get any worse. And that's the things you hear. But when it comes to doing something, that always doesn't seem to follow.
Homelessness is complex. There are many factors that drive people into homelessness. I think at core, it's a housing crisis and an affordability crisis. Most of the other challenges that people face that put them in a condition of instability are at root the fact that they can't afford their current housing. I think Angelenos want to address the crisis. I think Angelenos are facing significant increases in their rents, whether they're housed. We have a lot of owners who are paying more than half their income to hold their housing. Angelenos see those costs and they see the challenge. I think people have avoided the increase in density for many years, and that is something we're going to need to change Angelenos' perspectives on. We need to build more. We need to build more dense housing, and we need to build that around our transit opportunities so that people can get two jobs that will sustain them in that housing.
Peter, what would you say to people who are just scared?
I think that there is hope in these numbers. It is daunting to look at an increase after we have spent resources, but we have connected with tens of thousands of people that we would not otherwise have connected with, and we've doubled the number of people we're able to lift out of homelessness and place into housing. That is a remarkable increase in a tough rental market, because remember, we're rehousing people using mostly the mechanisms of the market. I think people need to recognize that this is a long-term challenge that we got ourselves into. We did not build enough housing for decades. We have had a lot of people who have been homeless for a while. There is a real sense of urgency on the part of the service providers, on the sense of the community, but there is a real crisis in terms of housing affordability. We need to increase our housing stock to address that, but in the meantime, the assistance that voters put in place is actually gaining traction. We're actually able to lift people out of homelessness at a much faster pace than we've ever been able to.
Peter, when it comes to messaging, I've been here at KPCC 7 years, and I kept hearing, especially when I first started, the goal is to end homelessness, just completely end it. But when you got numbers that came out as they did today, is ending homelessness still a realistic goal?
Absolutely. I think the only human and moral goal is ending homelessness. And if you think back to, when I was a kid...
It's a moral goal, Peter, but is it a realistic goal?
Well, I think we're going to need affordability at levels that we haven't invested in. And we need the state to take responsibility for that. It would be welcome to see our federal partners step up to invest in housing construction and production and resources. But I do think that Angelenos need to focus on the outcome of ending homelessness. It is an attainable goal. If we put the resources behind it, we can build the housing that we need. If we change the way the housing stock and the housing mix and make naturally affordable units that people with very low incomes can pay for, I think we can address this. But we're going to need to get innovative in the kinds of stock we're deploying as well.
Peter Lin is the executive director of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an information session to learn more. Classes start September. Apply by July 8th for a $1,000 scholarship at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. 30 years ago today, Chinese soldiers fired into a crowd of pro-democracy demonstrators. Hundreds were killed in what became known as the Tiananmen Square Massacre. In mainland China, it's often referred to as the June 4th incident. Any talk of the crackdown today is censored. But across the world, people observe that anniversary, and that includes Anna Wong. She's a Chinese-born writer who now lives in Irvine. Wong wrote about the events leading up to the massacre in her new memoir, Inconvenient Memories. And in it, she makes the case that the seeds for those protests were planted decades earlier. Since the Chinese Revolution in 1949, the economy had been strictly controlled.
Marching into the 1920s, the Chinese government realized that a planned economy wasn't sustainable, so they started experimenting with a hybrid economy.
She said that's when society started to change.
This unleashed ferocious productivity, and people's life had been raised greatly in a short period, but it also brought about inequality, corruption, and inflation.
When author Anna Wong spoke with KPCC's Josie Huang earlier, she said the country's students felt the effects the most.
On top of the general anger, students were faced with a special kind of anxiety of their own. Under the planned economy, if you finish a four-year degree, you're guaranteed a job and a residency in big city. But because of this newly emerging market economy, the rumor had it that starting from 1980, the government would stop sending jobs to college graduates. The students had been working so hard to get into their dream colleges, and suddenly the rules of the game changed, a major source of their anger and grief.
What about yourself? At the time of the protests, you were in your 20s. You were working for the Japanese camera company, Canon. Were you also taking part in these protests? Were you feeling the same kinds of anxieties?
Yeah, I was a little bit different from their feelings because I was working at a Japanese company, as you mentioned. My boss was very concerned when the protest started because he was afraid that the radical change of political scenarios would affect Canon's investment in China. At the time, Canon was just about to build its first ever assembly plant in China. So he sent me to Tiananmen Square to take pictures. So that's why I was on the square for 50 plus days. I was there almost every day. I took picture and I brought the picture back to my office. My boss would choose whatever he thought important and fax them to headquarters in Tokyo.
So over 50 days, you must have taken a lot of pictures. Are there any particular shots that still stick with you today?
I have one picture published, but I lost them all. They were destroyed by my grandmother.
And how did your grandmother end up destroying the photographs? Was that on purpose or accidental?
I think she did it on purpose. Yeah, she was afraid of the aftermath because the crackdown of the protest caused rift between citizens.
And how are you feeling about the protests yourself? You were right there on the square. You weren't with the protesters, but did you sympathize with what they were fighting for?
I watched the protests ongoing with a mixed feeling. On one hand, I still had this spirit of student in me because I'd gone to Peking University, and Peking University has this tradition of student protests. So I fell for the students' cause naturally. But on the other hand, because I was working for a foreign company and my job security, my livelihood, all depended on the success of this project, so I was kind of worried what's going on. My boss had a theory that he thought that the student protest started from a longing for democracy and the fear of the market economy. So at first, I disregarded his theory with disdain. But when I spent more time on the square, I began to think that he might have hit on something.
It was the evening of June 3rd that mm-hmm. communist leaders ordered the crackdown, the very violent mm-hmm. crackdown. Were you in the square at the time?
No, I wasn't there. I was standing on the street next to my grandmother's building with a group of neighbors. We heard gunshots, we smelled gunpowder, and we saw the dark sky was tinted with orange color. And because our building is right across Beijing Children's Hospital, we saw wounded people rush to the hospital.
There had been so much hope during the protest, before the massacre itself, that the Communist Party would reform itself. With this violent crackdown, what kind of message was being sent to the Chinese people?
I think at the time, there were three factions among the highest levels of the communist officials of China. We call them radical reformists, centrist reformists, and the conservatives. The radical reformists wanted not only to reform the economic system, but also the political system. The centrists wanted only to reform the economic system. The conservatives wanted neither. So the Tiananmen Square protest was a reflection of the highest power struggle. It could be roughly defined as a struggle between the radical reformists and the conservatives. But in the end, it's the centrists who called the shots. From the crackdown of the Tiananmen protest, China went on this road that led to its super economic power of today. China stopped reforming on its political system at all.
Right. Today, China is the world's second largest economy. It has a very prosperous middle class. And some observers thought that with all this economic advancement, that the Communist Party's grip on the country would loosen. But that hasn't been the case at all. In fact, President Xi has only tightened the vise. And I want to know what you think is going on there.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I want to write this book. Because right after the crackdown of the Tiananmen protest, many of my friends left the country. They were deeply disappointed. But my Japanese boss comforted me. And he said that as long as China's economy developed, democracy would surely come along with it. So I believed in his conviction at the time, so I stayed in China. But democracy didn't come to China despite of its booming economy. So I'm very disappointed.
You mentioned yourself and your friends have left China, and there's a drain, not just a brain drain, but also the drain of people who wanted to reform the country. Would you ever go back to live in China again to work towards that end?
I am not sure, because in China right now, any talk about Tiananmen Square protest is blocked. I have a social media account. It's called WeChat. It's popular within the Chinese community. But because I advertised this book, my WeChat account was permanently blocked. This morning, one of my friends' WeChat account was temporarily blocked because he helped to spread the word about this book. So they block any talk on this topic.
Younger generations don't know very much about Tiananmen Square. What do your children know about what happened? What do you tell them?
They have an idea, but they don't know the detail. So that's why I want to write this book to communicate with them.
Anna Wong wrote about living through Tiananmen Square in her new memoir, Inconvenient Memories. Thank you so much for joining us, Anna.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was KPCC's Josie Huang, who covers Asian American communities. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Last night was a big one for the culinary community in Los Angeles. The California Michelin Guide released its list of restaurants receiving stars and mentions. LAist food editor Elena Shatkin was there for the announcement. She joins us now to discuss which SoCal eateries made the cut and what the return of the list means for chefs and diners in the state. Hello, Elena.
Hi there.
All right. We have not had the Michelin Guide in California for a few years now. So let's
almost a decade.
Yeah. So let's start with some basics. Who is the guide for?
Okay. Well, the first thing you got to understand is that it's not really for Angelenos. It's not for people who live here. It is really and truly for tourists, probably international ones, but definitely wealthy ones. So a lot of the people who complain about the guide not truly representing the kind of restaurants we eat at on a day-to-day basis are absolutely right. It was never meant to do that. It has never done that. It will probably never do that.
So then what do we get out of it as Angelenos then?
It's really more of a thing for restaurateurs and chefs, because you have to understand, when you run a restaurant, you don't make all your money just from locals, but nor do you make it from tourists. And you have to serve both audiences if you want to stay in business, if you're a certain kind of restaurant, right? So if this restaurant convinces, you know, concierge in a fancy hotel, tell one of their patrons, hey, maybe go and check out this cool Thai restaurant in East Hollywood or this taqueria in downtown, instead of spending that money at, you know, the sort of typical fancy schmancy hotel restaurant, then in that way, Michelin Guide is kind of doing God's work.
All right. Now, any surprises or underdogs who made the list?
There's always some surprises about what got left off. Bestia got left off. République got left off. Bavel got left off. And probably the biggest thing that people complained about was that Los Angeles didn't get any 3-star restaurants.
Were you shocked by that?
Not at all.
I didn't know why.
I thought there was next to no chance that LA would get any 3-star restaurants. I mean, let's face it, the Michelin Guide, it's much better than it was a decade ago, but it has always had a very strong bias towards San Francisco and Northern California, and it's going to have to be here for at least one, maybe a couple years, and it's going to make the LA restaurants earn their 3 stars. So we had, I think, what was it, like 7 2-star restaurants, but no 3 stars. And I feel like next time around, those 2-star restaurants, some of them have a really good shot of becoming 3-star restaurants.
Now, you mentioned how the Michelin Guide hasn't been around in 10 years. So any differences that stood out to you in terms of the new list and the old list?
Well, the truth is that the Michelin Guide needs Los Angeles a lot more than Los Angeles needs the Michelin Guide. Now, when it was here last time around, about 2008, 2009, 2010, it had a really snooty director who just was incredibly insulting to Los Angeles. The restaurants, you know, anonymous, very opaque reviewers.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, chose were very dull and just did not at all reflect LA's vast diversity and culinary awesomeness. Does the new guy do that? No, not really.
not yet, right?
Not really, but it's a lot better. There are areas where it can do much, much better. It can do a lot better, most notably in covering Mexican, Central American, and South American cuisines, where it seemed just the sheer numbers, the lack of them was sort of like, whoa. But then again, the Michelin Guide has always had a very heavily Eurocentric POV, where it esteems certain cuisines as being elevated, right? French, Italian, Japanese. So those are the kinds of restaurants that are more likely to get 1, 2, and certainly 3 stars. So I really feel like the reviewers reflect that and need to broaden their perspective on the kind of precision and craft and depth it takes to cook excellent Mexican food, excellent Thai food, excellent Filipino food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So as much as LA restaurants need to be patient in terms of getting that 3rd star, maybe we need to be patient with the Michelin Guide in terms of representation, female chefs, just communities that maybe are not ones that are out there that much on an international stage.
I guess it's just that the Michelin Guide isn't all things to all people. It is a very narrow, specific sort of guide for a narrow, specific sort of audience from a narrow, specific sort of POV that is really more for people who don't live here on a day-to-day basis and want to maybe explore Los Angeles as, you know, visitors or tourists.
One last thing, Elena.
Now
that it's here, do you think chefs in LA will start to strive for stars, or should they?
I think some chefs and some restaurants of a certain sector will do that. For the vast majority of restaurants, let's face it, the Michelin Guide is utterly irrelevant. And as for 3-star restaurants, I think there's only like about 120 in the entire world. So it's not a reasonable or realistic standard for most restaurants or chefs to measure themselves against. But for a handful of high-end restaurants that really make their living in part on being known as a top-tier, one of the best restaurants in the world, it could really give them a boost.
That's Elena Shatkin, LA's food editor, talking to us about the California Michelin Guide's return and the restaurants and chefs who made the 2019 list. And if you want to see the full list of LA and OC restaurants mentioned in the guide, check out Elena's article on LAIST.com. Elena, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Thanks, A.